Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session of the call, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one on your phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would like to now turn the meeting over to Mr. Jerry Slaff. You may begin. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Jerry Slaff. I'm a public affairs officer with NOAA's Office of Communications. Thanks for calling in for today's teleconference on NOAA's new report, 2018 State of U.S. High-Tide Flooding with a 2019 Outlook. The study tracks changes in coastal high-tide flooding using national flooding thresholds at 98 NOAA tide gauges around the U.S. from May 2018 to April 2019. The report also provides projections for next year. Today's update will feature short presentations from the NOAA scientists who authored the report, followed by a question and answer session. A copy of the report can be found in our news release, which we sent out about 10 minutes ago. If you need a copy, please go to our homepage, www.noaa.gov, scroll down to the news and features section, and click on latest media releases. Our first presenter is Nicole LeBeouf. That's L-E-B-O-E-U-F, Acting Director of NOAA's National Ocean Service. And she'll provide a setting for the report and talk about the important role NOAA has in providing science and services to help coastal communities become more resilient to rising seas. Following Nicole, we will have Dr. Gregory Dusek, D-U-S-E-K, Chief Scientist at NOAA's Center for Operational Oceanographic Products and Services, known as COOPS, who will talk about NOAA's long history of maintaining tide stations and the National Water Level Observation Network. And our final speaker will be Dr. William Sweet, also known as Billy, an oceanographer at COOPS and lead author of the report, who will summarize its key findings. And we will begin with Nicole LeBeouf. Nicole, please go.
Good morning, everyone. As Jerry indicated, my name is Nicole LeBeouf. I'm the Acting Director of NOAA's National Ocean Service. As such, I have the distinct honor of leading America's premier ocean and coastal agency. The National Ocean Service provides data, tools, services, and on-the-ground expertise to support hazard preparedness and risk reduction, safe and efficient marine transportation, and coastal stewardship, recreation, and tourism. We supply timely and trusted science-based information to individuals, businesses, and communities who power and sustain the nation's blue economy, that ocean-dependent economic sector that produces $129 billion in wages and $304 billion in goods and services. I'm pleased to be a part of this call today to present our latest science about high tide flooding in the United States, an increasingly urgent issue that many coastal communities are grappling with as our seas continue to rise. This issue became more evident to me than ever before on a recent trip that I took to Norfolk, Virginia, a city experiencing some of the most severe impacts from coastal flooding in our entire nation. It was eye-opening to see firsthand just how disruptive and costly high tide flooding is to this important region of our country. While I was in Norfolk, I met with various government officials, partners, and regional stakeholders, and I came better to understand the challenges and successes communities are having in responding to and planning for impacts from high tide flooding. Some of my key takeaway lessons were, one, coastal flooding is a very complex issue. Two, addressing it will require resources, expertise, and efforts by many partners. And three, we cannot wait to act. This issue gets only more urgent and complex with each passing day. Ultimately, I came away with a greater understanding of what coastal communities are facing and how NOAA can assist and inform local sea level rise efforts now and going forward. Before we turn to the findings of the high tide flooding report, I wanted to highlight one of our newest decision support tools called the Coastal Inundation Dashboard. The dashboard includes findings from this report and helps coastal communities plan for the impacts of sea level rise. This new tool brings together key NOAA products and data from over 200 long-term coastal water level stations into one web-based tool that can help coastal communities monitor and prepare for all types of coastal flooding, from high tide flooding to flooding from storm events. The dashboard provides real-time water level information, 48-hour forecasts of water levels, and historic flooding information all together in one place. Having this information in a centralized location will help decision makers as well as coastal residents understand the shorter-term inundation risks, such as impacts from approaching hurricanes or nor'easters, as well as longer-term risks, such as from high tide flooding and sea level rise. As states and municipalities and the federal government and the public increasingly turn their attention to the impacts of coastal inundation and related hazards, they are looking to NOAA's National Ocean Service as an authoritative source of data and information on a wide range of risks. The combination of scientific, technical, and resource management expertise at NOS delivers not only timely and relevant reports, such as the state of high tide flooding, but also new tools to get science to the public, tools like the Coastal Inundation Dashboard and Digital Coast, among others. These efforts are representative of how NOS is well positioned not only as a data provider, but as a true and invested partner at the center of the national conversation on sea level rise. Thank you all for joining us today. I'd like to now turn it over to Dr. Greg Doucet.
Thank you, Nicole, for that great introduction. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the data that goes behind what enables us to provide this report and a little bit of background on the report. For those of you that aren't aware, our office, COOPS, the Center for Operational Oceanographic Products and Services, known also as the Tides and Currents Office of NOAA. One of the key services we provide to the nation is through our National Water Level Observation Network. This network is 210 real-time water level sensors throughout the coastal U.S. and Great Lakes, and many of the stations that make up this network have been operating since the early 1900s and in some cases have over 100 years of continuous data. The data we provide, the real-time water level data, is collected and provided every 6 minutes. And that data and the tide predictions that we provide from that data support things like safe and efficient marine navigation. But they also, because we have these long, continuous, high-quality data records, we're also able to track and provide information on things like sea level rise and high tide flooding and how these can vary from location to location and change over time. And so this network is really what enables us to provide the state of high tide flooding and outlook report that we're talking about today. So a little bit of background about the report. The report assesses the number of days with high tide flooding across the U.S. during 2018 and provides an outlook for 2019. Now, just to reiterate, when we're talking about these years, we're referencing the meteorological year. And so the observations from 2018 go from May of 2018 through April of 2019. And the outlook is from May of 2019 through April of 2020. This is the fifth year that we've done this type of report. And in the last two, we have provided this outlook overview and outlook for 98 tide gauges across the coastal U.S. Also new this year, in addition to the report, is we will have an interactive story map that will show you location by location, the information in the report, and that will be accessible on our website. Also, in the report and story map this year is information on the projections for high tide flood days in 2030 and 2050, as we wanted to be able to provide some context as to what is going to be expected in the near term. Also new in the report, you'll find additional information relating our observations to National Weather Service flood advisories that were issued in several locations as a way to compare how the observations we're making at our tide gauges relate to what the Weather Service is issuing for warnings. The report, in terms of the methodology, builds off of the NOAA Tech report that we released last February, in February of 2018, Patterns and Projections of High Tide Flooding Along the U.S. Coastline Using a Common Impact Threshold. And that report really focused on the development of the flood thresholds that we use to generate this information, which are developed by national, which is related from the information developed by National Weather Service forecast offices in conjunction with local emergency managers, as trying to indicate what levels do our gauges reach that show some level of flooding in local communities. And so in terms of the main purpose of the report, really what we're trying to do is track changes in high tide flooding over time throughout the U.S. and provide coastal communities information about what to potentially expect for the coming year. I should also mention that in addition to the report, we have something called the High Tide Bulletin, which is released every season, and it's available right now for this summer. And the bulletin provides regionally specific days and locations on when the tides are higher than normal and most likely to contribute to high tide flooding. And right now, for July, the next days that we're indicating as potential for increased likelihood of high tide flooding are at the end of July, July 29th through August 4th, depending on a particular region. So that's available right now on our website as well. And before I turn it over to Billy, I just wanted to give one example from the report, Baltimore, Maryland. Baltimore is kind of a unique gauge because it's one of our longest running gauges in the nation. It's been installed since 1902. And Baltimore, when the beginning of that gauge's installation, had 12 high tide flood days from 1902 to 1936. So over the first 35 years or so that gauge was installed, we saw 12 high tide flood days. This year, Baltimore had a record 12 high tide flood days in 2018 alone. And if you even go back as down to about year 2000, Baltimore was regularly seeing about 2 flood days per year. So I think this is a good example of just how dramatically high tide flooding is changing due to sea level rise. And I think it really points to the importance and the value that our NOAA tide gauge record has, in that it's really the only way that we're able to put these observations and these high tide flood numbers in historical context. And so I think it's just a great example of the value that our water level data has to the nation. So I'll let Billy now talk about some of the specifics of the report.
Thank you, Greg. Hi, everyone. This is William Sweet. So relative sea levels continue to rise. The ocean is now at the brim, clogging stormwater systems and routinely flooding U.S. coastal communities with salt water, often with no storm in sight. This is high tide flooding. This is sea level rise. More than 2,700 square miles of U.S. coastal lands are at risk of high tide flooding, and this is about 1.75 to 2 feet above the average high tide, some regions more so than others. This does not include rainfall flooding. Impacts. Just this year, sea level rise and high tide flooding were reported to be flooding roadways and disrupting traffic along the U.S. East Coast, cutting parking spaces and sales at stores in downtown Annapolis, Maryland, raising groundwater elevations and degrading septic system functionalities in South Florida, and salting farmlands within coastal Delaware and Maryland. Impacts are here and now. So this report, why are we doing this? This report is part of an annual series, as Greg mentioned, that tracks changes in the risks of high tide flooding, helps map its footprint, and helps inform decision-making about next year and decades to come. Communities need guidance as they plan and budget for both next year's flood responses, sort of reactive in nature, maybe closing streets and installing pumps. There's a cost to mobilization. And two, sort of the long-term major infrastructure, planning and maintenance and upgrades. So that's what these reports are geared towards. So let's do the numbers. In 2018, the national median high tide flood frequency hit 5 days and tied the all-time record set in 2015. Relative sea levels, again, the U.S. median, were over 31 centimeters, or about 1 foot higher than they were in 1920. This is the second highest level in about the last 100 years. 12 individual locations out of those 98 that we are tracking broke or tied their individual high tide flood records. 7 National Weather Service's weather forecast offices also issued record numbers of coastal flood advisories to the public. So this really is a weather meet climate story. Overall, high tide flooding was most prevalent along the Northeast Atlantic coast. There was a median of 10 days at these stations, with several records set within the Chesapeake Bay, 22 days in Washington, D.C., and 12 days apiece in Baltimore and Annapolis. Records were also set along the eastern Gulf of Mexico coast, with some major flooding in both regions, the North Atlantic as well, from hurricanes, causing more major flooding. Of concern, the decadal trends in high tide flooding and their impacts are now accelerating on an annual basis, or that means curving upwards at over 40 locations. And they're linearly increasing at 25 locations. So together what this means is without adaptation, impacts are likely to become chronic sooner than later. 2019 outlook. A minor El Nino is predicted to persist through next year with higher than normal high tide flooding in response at over 40 locations along the U.S. west and east coasts. The normal, or the baseline, however, continues to rapidly shift on an upward trajectory in many of these locations. So it's a compounding effect. Not only is sea level rise causing these accelerating trends in many locations, El Nino compounds that even further. The national median high tide flood frequency is projected to be more than 100% more than it was in the year 2000. Regionally, 8 days median value along the Northeast Atlantic is expected, and that's a 140% increase over what would have been expected in year 2000. 5 days are projected along the Southeast Atlantic, and that would be a 190% increase over year 2000. 3 days along the eastern Gulf of Mexico, that's a 100% increase over 2000. 6 days along the western Gulf, that's a 130% increase since year 2000. 2 days along the southwest Pacific, that would be an 80% increase since 2000. And 6 days along the Pacific Northwest, and that would be a 20% increase since year 2000. So this is primarily an issue right now in the East Coast and Gulf Coasts of the U.S. and to some extent the southern Pacific coasts. So in perspective, how things have been changing, what happened in 2018, what's likely or projected to happen in 2019, we also are providing 2030 and 2050 projections based on work we did in last year, as Greg had mentioned, the patterns and projections of high tide flooding. This is to sort of keep perspective of change that is occurring. In essence, the future is already here in terms of sea level rise impacts, and that's why we're having these reports and these calls. The current trajectory suggests a, let's say, a floodier future, bounded by a range of relative sea level rise under both a lower and a continued high emission rate that was produced by NOAA in 2017 and used in the fourth National Climate Assessment. Today's national high tide flood frequency of 5 days is likely to increase to somewhere between 7 and 15 days by 2030 on average, and between 25 and 75 days by 2050. Locally, these rates will be much higher in many East and Gulf Coast locations. So to put that into perspective, by the time a new 30-year mortgage is paid off by about 2050, the New York City region, which had about 12 days of high tide flooding in 2018, will experience somewhere between 55 and 135 days of high tide flooding on average. Baltimore, as Greg had mentioned, had took 35 years to have 12 days of high tide flooding. It had 12 days of flooding in 2018, and it will have somewhere between 50 and 155 days on average by 2050. Norfolk, which had 10 days of high tide flooding last year, likely to have somewhere between 170 days per year. And the last example would be the Galveston-Houston region, which had 13 days of high tide flooding, likely to have somewhere between 100 and 215 days per year on average. So with that, those are the numbers. I'll turn it back over to Jerry.
Thank you, Billy. We'll now take questions from our participants. Please be sure to indicate who you would like to answer the question, either Dr. Dusick or Dr. Sweet, if possible. Operator, please remind our callers how they can ask a question and queue up the first call, please.
Thank you. To ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone. To withdraw your question, please press star 2. Once again, press star 1. Thank you. One moment for our first question. Okay. We have a question from Travis from Hudson Public Media. Your line is now open.
Hi. Sorry, Houston Public Media.
Okay.
Hi. Yeah, I was hoping y'all could just talk broadly about, you know, why exactly the impacts are already seemingly worse and or expected to be worse for, you know, the Northeast Atlantic as opposed to the Gulf Coast here. I mean, I'm obviously concerned mostly about Texas, but just the Gulf in general.
Hi, this is William Sweet. Well, both areas are experiencing relative high rates of sea level rise and high tide flooding. The Gulf has a fair amount of hurricane protection in place, which is also serving some mediation from high tide flooding events, though not necessarily in terms of clogging of stormwater systems, back bay flooding in areas that may not necessarily be fronted by large seawalls. That said, the Northeast Atlantic, has high rates of relative sea level rise, as does the Gulf. Heavily urbanized, and it has a very energetic system, a lot of nor'easters, a lot of motion from winds and currents that is a little bit different than the Gulf in that besides the occasional hurricane, which obviously is very problematic in the Gulf, the Northeast Atlantic is a highly energetic, exposed area that gets a lot of forcing, and that forcing causes the waters to deviate fairly substantially and causes more instances of these high tide flooding days. So it's a combination of the high sea level rise rates as well as a very active ocean.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Craig Miller from KQED. Your line is now open.
Oh, thank you. I was wondering if you had any, and this is probably for Dr. Sweet, but you guys can decide who should take this. But I'm curious whether you had any specific projections for places like Pacifica, California, and the coastal erosion issue there that's already had apartment buildings falling into the sea and so forth, or high tide flooding projections for San Francisco Bay.
Sure, this is William Sweet. We do have the values for San Francisco Bay in terms of high tide flooding. These numbers there are, again, about 1.75 feet above high tide, so it's fairly noticeable when these levels hit. Not that frequent yet, so more or less next year, somewhere between 0 and 2 days. So, again, this is something that might happen on maybe an annual or twice-a-year type basis. You know, out to 2050, somewhere between 6 and 25 days in San Francisco. Basically, on the West Coast, the rates of sea level rise have been less over the last several decades, though that seems to be changing in the last several years with a switch in some Pacific Cicadal Oscillation. And the very narrow, deep continental shelf just doesn't really allow waters to set up. More of an issue there, as you mentioned, is erosion from big wave events and maybe possibly rain. We don't really characterize the erosion risk at our office. We really look at it in terms of high tide flooding that relates to water on street, more urbanized type setting from a weather service. I bet your best reference there would be the U.S. Geological Survey, who do all sorts of sea level rise and wave-induced erosion and bluff collapse type work for California, and we could put you in touch with some contacts there, need be.
And this is Greg Dusek, too. Just to let you know that if you're curious about specific locations, you know, you can look at, again, at our story map, which is live right now on our website, and see which areas might be closest to a specific area of interest that you have.
Operator, do we have any other questions?
Thank you. To submit a question, please press star 1 on your phone. Thank you.
Operator, do we have any questions?
At this time, I do not have any further questions. Oh, one moment. I do have a question from Kim Miller from Palm Beach Post. One moment, please.
Thank you.
Kim, your line is now open.
Hi. So I was wondering, 2015, we had a couple super moons. There was stuff going on that kind of increased the tidal flooding in South Florida. What was it this year or last year that made it tie the 2015 tides?
Again, this is William Sweet. The 2015, you know, we did have the super moons. We were at some peak of some long tidal cycle periods, the nodal cycle just made the predicted tides a bit higher. This year, in that part of Florida, we did have some brushes by some hurricanes that went by, some pretty, you know, major offshore events that had caused some high tide flooding in the vicinity. Yeah. So, again, oftentimes in that part of the country, it's a balance between sort of the Gulf Stream variability and what the actual predicted tides are doing, the Earth, Moon, Sun sort of cyclists doing, as well as any instances of hurricanes that might be offshore or come landfall.
Okay. Can I ask also, I'm looking at the interactive map that has the pins on it. How does NOAA track high tide flooding? My pins aren't working, but it looks like there's a pin north of Miami, and I'm wondering where that is, if that's Lake Worth.
Yeah, if you keep going through the map, you'll have the interactive portion. So it's been a couple slides down. So if you keep browsing through, you'll see the point where you can click on the points and see the values and zoom in and things like that. There's a click to view interactive map, it says. I think maybe two slides beyond the one you're on or so.
Okay. But see, that one doesn't have a pin north of Miami. Well, besides Orlando area.
I think
yeah.
There was some active stations that are monitoring water levels, and then the actual stations that were used to track high tide flooding are a slightly different subset of those. So the closest pins that would be bounding your particular area would be sort of the between the Mayport, Florida, or Trident Pier, which is Cape Canaveral, and then Virginia Key, which is down towards Miami.
Okay. You guys spoke a lot about the Northeast. I mean, Florida's always been considered, you know, ground zero for this kind of thing. What was there something that we weren't as bad this year in Southeast Florida than in the Northeast?
Well, in terms of overall flooding, again, it's a little calmer typically down as you head south of Hatteras, basically Cape Hatteras, due to the orientation of the land, not really exposed to these northeasterly wind events. In general, without these hurricanes coming by, it tends to be a bit calmer. People like to live down there. It's nice and calm. Winter weather is very nice, whereas you head up north, it just tends to be more active. Again, it's that interplay, too, as to what your actual tide ranges are doing, and they have some long period cycles, 19-year cycles, so you can peak every 4 to 8 years in terms of tide range. So it really, in terms of overall numbers, they're higher in the Northeast than the Southeast Atlantic. But we should point out that your rates have been changing, 190% increase since 2000 for the Southeast Atlantic. So whether that goes to, 1 to 2 to 4 to 5, it becomes consequential, and the very flat topography there with saltwater intrusion, there's lots of other issues associated with sea level rise and high tide flooding that is somewhat unique to the southeast area of the Atlantic.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Alex Harris. Your line is open.
Hey there. I'm with the Miami Herald. I'm looking similarly to Kim down at Virginia Key, and I know it says we've got zero high tide flood days in 2018. We had a pretty mild king tide this year, but it still flooded. Did that just not meet the threshold for flood days?
Again, we're using a national consistent pattern now, so based on these flood thresholds that have been set throughout all the regions and across the nation, and so we're trying to normalize. And so really what this means is we're tracking a slightly deeper and more severe flood than may have actually you witnessed on the ground. So I know for a fact in some of those areas, flooding will start at a slightly lower threshold. So, again, we're trying to make this national comparison. So it doesn't mean that you didn't actually experience some water in the streets and stormwater infiltration or, you know, your citizens notifying the media saying, hey, we're flooding, what's going on? It's just in terms of the severity of the flood that we're tracking. We're tracking a slightly deeper, again, more severe, widespread impact. Not to say that you didn't experience some issues with sea level rise and related flooding that, you know, again, one threshold doesn't fit all. You know, from your house to your church to your work to your public work system that might be of concern, they're all going to have slightly different elevations or magnitudes or durations that become problematic. So, you know, in future years, we may start tracking several different thresholds that might relate better to locally what people are actually observing and seeing.
And this is Greg. I also add that, you know, when we're talking about the southeast and our thresholds there, topography tends to obviously be much, much flatter. And so when we do reach those thresholds, you'll often see sizable amounts of flooding compared to, say, what we might see in the northeast due to the steeper topography in some cases. So there's certainly a topographic impact as well in terms of the amount of flooding you're going to see when we hit these threshold levels.
Right, so if we hit nothing this year, by 2019, if we see 1 to 3, it's some pretty insane flood days. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, our next question comes from Frank Coomer. Your line is not open.
Hi, I hate to keep dragging this back to the Northeast, but could someone address Atlantic City specifically, just because it is so salient to our readers, especially at this height of the shore season?
Sure, absolutely. This is William Sweet. So in 2018, again, you can get a lot of this right off the map, had 9 days of high tide flooding. Next year, it's projected to be between 8 and 14 days. The record for Atlantic City was 22 days, and that was in 2017. Projecting outwards to 2030, somewhere between 20 and 35 days of high tide flooding on average. And when we get to 2050, or about 30 years from now, somewhere between 65 and 155 days on average. So, you know, sort of above the median, consequences or impacts are being felt now, and this is definitely one of the reasons we're doing this type of work is to help communities like Atlantic City get a better handle of, you know, what their current rates are and what their trajectory is so they can make smart planning decisions.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Maya. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Maya Earls, and I'm with ClimateWire at E&E News. I have a question about your projections. Are they based on kind of current emission rates, or do they take into account, you know, if emissions go up or if they go down, you know, as set out in the Paris Climate Accords?
Sure, this is William Sweet. Our 2019 projections for next year are based solely on historical observations up to last year, as well as any influences from El Nino. Mm-hmm. So it's really steeped in history projecting forward. When we go out to 2030 and 2050, we are using two scenarios that bound a likely rise in sea level under a continued high emission rate, as well as a lower emission rate that correspond to basically an RCP 8.5, and the lower rate would be the RCP 4.5, and those stand for representation concentration pathway. So they are emission related, but they could be more extreme, but these are the more likely outcomes under current conditions. So this is written about in a NOAA report as well as the Fourth National Climate Assessment.
Okay.
And just to add something, this is Greg. I think it's important to note, you know, if you look at the projection numbers, even the low end, I think one of the important points is that even if sea level rise continues on a low rate of increase, we are still going to see in many cases an acceleration in the number of days of high tide flooding. So you don't need an acceleration in sea level rise to see an acceleration in the number of flood days because it's the combination of sea level rise and the tides kind of working together. And so So even, you know, under some of the better case scenarios for sea level rise increases, some of these locations, particularly on the East Coast, Gulf Coast, we're likely to see an acceleration in high tide flood days regardless.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Sophia. Please introduce yourself.
Met with Delaware Public Media. So I was wondering, one of the four kind of key takeaways that are mentioned from 2018 is salting farmlands in coastal Delaware and Maryland. Did you look specifically at how that could, will it continue or accelerate in 2019 and, you know, at the 2030, 2050 points?
This is William Sweet. The reporting that we point out here is our, you know, news and journal article type reporting that we get and verify and read up on. So it's not our direct, investigation into this fact. But what is occurring there is very likely to continue. Sea level rise is not going down. Sea level rise is only going to continue to increase in these areas, high tide flooding. Water over land, you know, that's starting to either directly salt or force sort of subsurface effects are going to continue, and they're going to become more severe in time. So we have every expectation that what's going on now will continue next year and into the future as well.
Got it. Thank you. And I guess if I could ask one more question, some of the 2050 projections across the board, but also at the two monitoring points in Delaware, are pretty striking. And, you know, in one of our locations, there's a lot of beachfront property, as in a lot of these locations. Do you have any, recommendations to, you know, local, county level, or state level governments for preparing for what the reality is going to look like in 2050?
I think most importantly is to get a handle on where impacts are happening now and to use the tide gauge data and the local weather forecast office's guidance as to how impacts are manifesting, what that actually means to the local community, but then to use these outlooks and these projections in tandem with planning and what is considered important for these communities so that they can protect their lifestyles and their habitats and their way of life to maintain, you know, over the next 10, 20, 30 years into the future. And that's sort of the main purpose we're providing this, is to get a better handle on what's occurring now and what's likely to unfold so communities can act accordingly.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Carolyn. Please introduce yourself. One moment, please. Carolyn, your line is now open.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Gramling with Science News Magazine. I was just wondering if Dr. Sweet could comment on the role of isostatic rebound and some of the regional differences, particularly the Chesapeake Bay area, and how that might have been built into looking into the projections for 2030 and 2050.
Absolutely. Well, the rebound effect, as you're mentioning, is an important one. It's one of the main drivers of vertical land motion. Most of the mid-Atlantic area is subsiding somewhere between 1 and 3 millimeters a year, that some of which is natural due to the last ice age, as you had mentioned. That is built into these projections. The projections themselves have a ocean rise component as well as a continuation of observed rates of subsidence. So if you're subsiding, let's say, if you have a relative increase of, because of subsidence of 3 millimeters a year, that's about about an inch every 8 years just from subsidence itself. So that is a factor. So that is something that is real, and it's important to consider, and we project that in the future. I would add there's another component in the Chesapeake, since you mentioned it, that is another sort of unnatural factor is withdrawal of fresh water. At the coast, a lot of communities get their water from aquifers, and they pump these aquifers, and it actually makes the sediments compact. So, and oftentimes you have a sort of a two-prong effect of both natural subsidence and human-induced subsidence. We take that rate that's being computed at the tide gauges and through GPS systems, and we project that in the future. The isostatic rebound will maintain its current rates for a very long time, whereas if the anthropogenic withdrawal of fresh water would cease, that component might stop as well.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Okay, our next question comes from Cecilia. Please introduce yourself. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Cecilia Smith with the U.S. News and World Report. Thanks for doing this call. My question could be for either of you guys. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the sort of big picture impacts of climate change and what effect that might be having on these increased number of days that we're seeing now and we'll continue to see in the future.
Sure. This is William Sweet. Well, global sea level rise is currently rising about 1 inch every 8 years, and it's starting to take effect. Locally, the rates are higher in many areas because of what we had just discussed, land subsidence, rates of 3, 4, 5 millimeters per year, which equates to somewhere between an inch every 5 to 7 years in many areas, it's really starting to take its toll. Sea level rise has caught up. We're losing freeboard, or the distance or space between our infrastructure and the ocean. And it's starting to impact our infrastructure that's subsurface, like stormwater systems, freshwater systems, wastewater systems, as well as a lot of infrastructure at ground level, roads, property. So it's not a year 2100 issue. Sea level rise is tightly coupled to a changing climate and a warming atmosphere and an ocean. That global rise rate we just mentioned is about two parts ice melt of land-based ice in Antarctica, Greenland, and mountain glaciers, and one part thermal expansion. The impacts are now, we're feeling them, and that's why we're doing these types of reports, is to keep tabs in how flood risk is changing within the coastal floodplain, to give projections so folks can get a better handle on what to expect as they plan and prepare for the future.
Great, thanks.
Once again, if you would like to submit a question, please press star 1 on your phone. Our next question will come from Will. Your line is open. Please introduce yourself.
Michaels at North Carolina Public Radio. I had a regional-specific question as well. I was wondering if you could just talk about some of the vulnerabilities. We had a tough year here, obviously, with Florence and Michael, but when it comes to high-tide flooding, what are some of the particular vulnerabilities in the southeast and in North Carolina for high-tide flooding and that increase that we've seen?
This is William Sweet. Well, as you mentioned, areas in the Gulf as well as the Southeast Atlantic, including North Carolina, face sort of a two-pronged threat, both from hurricanes when they do occur, as well as sea level rise and high tide flooding. So I'm actually from North Carolina, so I recognize the fact that it's very low-lying and flat as you get down in the coastal plain in the Pamlico Albemarle Sound area. Sea level rises and we get more of these events and winds blow and Gulf Stream transport picks up and slows down. You know, what we're seeing is we're seeing more instances of flooding in areas like Wilmington and Beaufort and the Outer Banks, as you get down into the South Carolina Myrtle Beach area, north up to Norfolk. So it really is an issue. We see freshwater sources being more contaminated with saltwater. We start to see transition in ecosystems. Flooding of roadways, again, is a problem. So it's tough because you plan for the big events. You can put houses up on stilts. You can fortify roadways. But then the minor events are hard to defend by. You can't sort of build that wall everywhere. The water will come in where the water wants to go through subsurface stormwater systems, back bay flooding. So it's sort of a hard thing to protect both against the big and the less salient effects of sea level rise, high tide flooding.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Mary. Please introduce yourself. Your line is now open.
Okay, I'm Mary Landers. I'm with the Savannah Morning News. I'm wondering if local governments can use this report to not only anticipate the number of days of flooding, but the height of that flooding. And I'm thinking specifically about the road flooding near Fort Pulaski here near Savannah.
Absolutely. I know that road sort of going, well, one of the roads going out to Tybee Island is particularly susceptible to high-tide flooding and cuts off a community when it's high, and I know they're in the process of raising that road. These elevations that we're using are well-tuned in that particular area of, let's say, Fort Pulaski and Savannah and Charleston. They really do equate to impacts on the ground. Again, this is not including rainfall flooding. When it rains, oftentimes the downhill gradient is no longer there. The water is just not clearing anymore. That can cause additional problems. So, again, these projections are at least a first-order estimate as to what could be expected next year, let's say one or two decades from now, in terms of water on streets that in areas, identifying those areas that are especially prone and problematic when it does flood. So emergency managers and resiliency managers can identify these areas and really start to holistically look at their community and recognize areas that they are vulnerable and can plan accordingly to mitigate for those types of effects.
And this is Greg. I'd also like to, again, take a chance to just mention our high tide bulletin, which, again, provides kind of specific days where we're also likely to see those flooding, that, you know, most likely to see flooding occur, especially when it's driven by the tides. And we also, you know, we do that regionally right now, but we also call out specific locations that are most likely to hit their flood thresholds. And in the future, we'll be kind of providing even more specific location guidance with that product to be able to provide, you know, more along the lines of at Fort Pulaski, at specific locations, what days, even what times you're likely to see those highest tides and potential flooding.
And one other comment on that, one of our other tools we mentioned in Digital Coast of Sea Level Rise Viewer, they have a flood exposure mapper. You can actually click on high tide flooding, and it will, we showed this in the report, but you can actually see the land elevations that are exposed or at risk to high tide flooding, and you can zoom in to actually street level to see if you're in an area that is potentially at risk to the flooding that we're talking about here in terms of the outlooks and projections.
Okay, our next question comes from Chloe. Your line is now open.
Hey, all. This is Chloe Johnson at the Post and Courier in Charleston. Excuse me. So I'm looking at the interactive map that has sort of specific points and these long-range projections. And I know y'all said you're using a national sort of standard for this flood threshold in Charleston. It's 0.57 meters above mean high water. And so, as was remarked upon before, the number of flood days seems a little bit low here, and particularly the long-term projections. The projection the city of Charleston has been using is that, and their sea level rise report is that by 2045, there could be tidal flooding as many as 180 days a year. Can you speak a little more to how those flood thresholds at specific locations are determined?
Absolutely. So the actual Weather Service flood threshold for Charleston is about a half foot lower than the actual threshold that we're now tracking. And again, you know, it's to really try to make this uniform comparison. See, the way that these weather forecast offices, in conjunction with emergency managers, they oftentimes are using these tide gauges based upon years of impact monitoring to communicate a threat to a particular region or part of a city that will have a differences in topography, urbanization, storm proofing, and we're really trying to broadly speak across regions and speak across nations so that we're really sort of doing an apples-to-apples comparison. So I know those actually particular numbers you're referencing were the slightly lower threshold. Again, there has been some stormwater improvements in Charleston. There's actually been discussions, should they raise the threshold some, because they're doing a good job of clearing water off the streets and reducing the number of days of high tide flooding in terms of actual impact. So, again, it's all dependent upon what the flood defenses are currently, and they may change in the future, they may not. The level we're projecting now is a half foot deeper, which is going to be a more severe, widespread flood than the numbers that you were referencing prior. Mm-hmm. So, again, one number and one threshold won't fit all, but we're trying to do this sort of uniformly across the nation so that all communities can benefit from from some insights in terms of what their risk is to high tide flooding today.
Thanks. And I'm sorry, just to be clear, the amount of high tide flood days seemed low to me, not the actual threshold itself in Charleston.
Well, okay. So just to clarify there, too. So as in anything, the higher or the more severe the flood, the less there are of them.
Yeah.
So think about this in terms of the bell-shaped kind of curve. When you get further out in the curve or further out a higher threshold, there's usually less of them. So that's why when you have a higher threshold, your flood count goes down.
Thanks.
Once again, if you would like to submit a question, please press star 1 on your phone. Our next question comes from Craig Miller. Your line is now open.
Yes, thanks. And thanks to ClimateWire for asking the emissions question. But I didn't quite grasp the answer. It sounded like Greg was saying that you had two emissions scenarios kind of baked into your models for projections. I'm a little unclear. When you go and click on New York and the projections come up, are you seeing projections from one or the other of those scenarios or an average of the two? Or can you just kind of recap that a little bit?
Sure, and this is William Sweet. I was the one who made that reference earlier. So, no problem. So what you actually see when you click on a location, let's say for 2050, you'll have two numbers. The lower number is going to be, on average, what you see on the lower scenario, what we call the intermediate low scenario, or the low end of what is likely to occur under the fourth National Climate Assessment, under either a lower emission scenario. That's what you could expect to see. So that would be an average over for 2050, that would be an average from 2041 to 2050. On average, by 2050, you would expect to see about that number. There could be variability on every given year, but on average in a year, you'd see that. The higher number would be the higher scenario. So one way to think about this, though, is we are actually tracking relative to these trajectories on our website, so you can kind of see that the variability historically between these scenarios on a year-to-year basis, we're kind of bouncing around between those two. So it does a pretty good job thus far qualitatively to bound the future, but the fourth National Climate Assessment, those were chosen as the more likely outcomes for risk planning purposes. Could be higher. It's probably not going to be lower. So that's sort of bounding what you would expect on average, the lower number being the lower value and the higher number being the higher scenario.
Okay, so neither of the scenarios are business as usual. Even the lower one is, I think you said, a low intermediate?
Well, the lower value you see there would be a reduced emission scenario. The higher number you would see would be sort of a continuation as business as usual.
Okay, it would be a bit. Okay. Thanks.
But, I would stress it's not the highest scenarios that we have. We have scenarios that go above that, but if those scenarios would unfold, they'd likely be much later in the century, and they have a much lower likelihood of occurring in general. So we're sort of trying to give sort of the best guesstimate of a range of what's likely to unfold.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification.
Sure.
Our next question comes from Jennifer Kay. Your line is not open. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, thank you. This is Jennifer Kay from Bloomberg Law. I just had a question about the El Nino effect. Can you explain how that contributes to the increased flooding on top of sea level rise? I know that it tends to suppress hurricane development, so it sounds like a good thing for storms, but maybe not so much with flooding.
Absolutely. This is William Sweet. So I think it's really something important for us to start considering in this country when El Ninos form. Typically, we discuss it in terms of changes in precipitation patterns or wet and dry, hot and cold, you know, where you might consider taking your ski trip out west, you know, where you're more likely to get the snow than not. But in terms of high tide flooding, you're more apt to flood on both the west and east coast. So the mechanism behind that is along the west coast of the United States during an El Nino, you tend to have warmer ocean waters, a deeper thermocline. You have a higher sea surface, prolonged oftentimes for months at a time, that your tides and any storms that might occur are riding higher upon that. On the East Coast, it's more of a teleconnected kind of effect. And what I say by that, it's more of an atmospheric response. You tend to get changes in your storm tracks. You tend to get more of a zonal jet stream. You tend to get storms that track along the mid-Atlantic during an El Nino, and you tend to also get changes in your prevailing winds. They become a little less westerly and more sort of northwesterly, and it tends to cause a slight increase in sea levels along the East Coast as well. So it's more of an atmospheric response on the East Coast and more of a direct ocean response on the West Coast. But both of these areas show sensitivity and a significant change when El Niños form. And so that's an important factor when we look to next year, is what is El Niño likely to do? And in this case, it's likely to persist into next year, and we factor that into our outlook.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all. I want to thank Nicole, Greg, Billy, and our operator for this call. An audio recording of the call on MP3 will be found on the NOAA Media Advisory that was sent out a few days ago on this on our website in about an hour. Again, you can reach that by going to www.noaa.gov, scroll down to News and Features, and look at Latest Media Advisories. If you have any further questions or need some follow-up, please email me at Jerry, that's J-E-R-R-Y dot Slaff, S as in Sam, L-A-F-F, as in Frank, at NOAA.gov, or my colleague Brady Phillips at Brady.Phillips@NOAA.gov. Thanks for participating, and that's the end of our call, folks. Thanks.
This concludes today's conference. You may all disconnect. Thank you.